Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Hello there, thanks for joining us. It's a particularly fond hello to all you disappointed Eels fans as Melbourne wrests League's prize for the second time in 3 years. And it's to Melbourne we travel for much of tonight's program, where the past couple of weeks have seen some tumult and shouting that was not just associated with football. The issue has been discrimination, in particular the right of voluntary associations such as churches and some other bodies to be free of the constraints of equal opportunity legislation so that they can discriminate in matters of employment on the grounds of sexual orientation, religious belief and even marital status. Last week, the Attorney General in Victoria, Rob Hulls, appeared to cave in the face of pressure from religious and other groups and abandoned plans for vigorously beefed up EEO legislation in favour of a much softer option, preserving the ability for some continued discrimination in the workplace. For some, this represents a blow against basic workers' rights. For others, a triumph of reasonableness when it comes to freedom of belief. It's an issue that may have even greater resonance as Australians over the next few weeks and months begin serious discussions over a national charter of rights. So, should employers be able to discriminate on the basis of religion, sexual orientation, gender, marital status? And if so, who? If one employer can do it, why not others? Should religious groups be free to teach and exercise their beliefs, even if they are not consistent with the prevailing temper of society? And what happens if government money is involved, such as schools, hospitals, and even welfare services? Well, it's a pleasure to welcome into our discussion this evening the Victorian convener of the Australian Christian Lobby, Rob Ward. Rob, welcome to you.
And good evening, John.
The Anglican Bishop of Gippsland, Right Reverend John McIntyre, who joins us from Canberra. John, thanks for joining us.
That's okay, John.
The Chair of Liberty Victoria, Michael Pearce, will be with us in a moment on the phone. And we also have Dr. Kevin Donnelly, Director of Education Strategies. Kevin, welcome to you.
Good evening.
Thank you all for joining us. Perhaps I could come to you, Rob, and ask what concerned you about the proposals being made by Victorian Attorney General Rob Hulls in his proposed look at the whole issue of EEO, and what things were changed to your satisfaction?
Well, to be fair to Rob Hulls, these actually weren't his proposals, so I'm happy to blame Rob Hulls when he gets things wrong, but I can't blame him for this one. The matter was referred to a cross-party, cross-house committee called the Scrutiny of Acts and Regulations Committee, and they had been examining the issue for some time. They'd received, I think, somewhere over 1,200, 1,300 submissions, had 2 days of public hearings. The committee had commissioned some researchers to produce an options paper, and that's really what got things going, because the options paper made some pretty drastic recommendations for changes to the law. Authored by Beth Gaze, and I must apologise, I can't remember the name of the second author. It divided religious activities into core and non-core, and that's quite a bit of a construct. It basically was saying that worship and other things were core issues, and you were free to basically practice your faith as you felt led there. But the moment you stepped out of those core activities into anything in the public square, then your religious freedom would have been reduced. And so that's what worried a lot of Christian groups, in fact, indeed, other faith groups as well. So the public hearings that took place over those couple of days certainly showed a fairly united front against reducing those religious freedoms that we currently enjoy.
Now, the Anglican Bishop of Gippsland, the Reverend John McIntyre, as I said, is with us. John is one of those who took a different view on this issue, but also from a religious perspective. John McIntyre, let me ask you first up, isn't this whole question of whether religion is a public or a private matter a very critical issue? And to actually define religion into only the private sphere, as Rob has indicated, would be something that, on the surface at least, one would think you would support Rob Ward's position on.
Well, yeah, that's not the issue that's of concern to me, though. I don't think that you can divide religion in that way either. What I am concerned about is that the churches are seeking exemption from an act that in its objective is seeking to affirm the dignity of every human being. And it just seems bizarre to me that the churches seek exemption from such an act.
And you would say that the churches, even if they have beliefs about, for example, things like homosexuality, which a number of churches do very strongly, should not be able to exercise those beliefs in the arena of employment?
What I'm saying is that where the churches are running organisations that are educational organisations or caring organisations, then they have every right to establish the kind of ethos that they want to establish, but they have no right to discriminate against another human being on the basis of their marital status, their sexuality, their gender, or their disability, or whatever.
That can take you into some complex turf in exercising this, what could be there, a very difficult area of judgment. You're suggesting that the easiest way out of this is just to actually say, no, everybody will conform to the civil law on this issue.
Well, I think that my greatest concern is that the church somehow, or churches somehow, seem to believe that the only way that they can run an appropriately Christian organisation is to have exemption from a law that affirms the rights of every human individual. It seems just a strange thing that we as churches, I shouldn't say they, I'm part of a church, that we as churches should actually be claiming exemption from a law that affirms a value that's at the very heart of our belief.
I'd like to come back and explore some of those issues in just a few moments. Kevin Donnelly, as somebody who's worked in the area of education for many years and currently the Director of Education Strategy, you're known as a writer on education issues. Here's an issue that relates to the nature of civil society. Why, for you, was this an important one to speak up on?
It's a vital issue on a number of grounds. One is that, and I taught for 18 years, I think anybody who's been a teacher in a school will know that it's very important, especially in religious schools, that there's agreement about what the philosophy is, the educational philosophy, the values, embedded in the curriculum in a broader sense. So I think from a teaching point of view, it's very important that you have staff, you're able to employ staff, who agree wholeheartedly with the mission of the school or the curriculum, the philosophy of the school. Secondly, parents have the right to choose whether their children go to a secular school or a religious school. And all the research is showing that parents who choose religious or faith based schools do so because the values of those schools are in line with or agree with what the parents feel to be true in terms of what they wish their children to have in terms of an education. Now, it's interesting that the current Equal Opportunity Act in Victoria supports the right of religious schools to make that choice to discriminate, and also the Freedom of Religion and Belief in the 21st Century discussion paper, which is a bit of a mouthful, that was released earlier this year, I think, Commonwealth Government. Also, the Charter of Rights and Responsibilities Act 2006. If you look at all the agreements, state, local, international, they all pretty much agree with the right of religious institutions to discriminate, and in areas like education, for example, to be able to say that if there's a teacher whose lifestyle or whose educational philosophy is contradictory to what the school is trying to do, then they shouldn't have to employ them.
Michael Pearce is the convener of Liberty Victoria, an agency concerned with civil liberties. Michael, you've had a background in the law for many years. You're somebody who's been very vigorously in favour of the changes that were initially proposed. Can you outline why you would disagree with what Kevin Donnelly has outlined there?
Well, I think we basically agree with Bishop McIntyre's position on this. We understand that there are certain aspects of certain religions and certain faiths that make certain lifestyles, for want of a better word, unacceptable. And in the practice of their religion, that's okay. But to take it the next step and to discriminate in employment practices, for example, we think goes too far.
And this goes further than employment practices, doesn't it? It goes into the area of marital status, sexual orientation, and it's beyond educational institutions. It goes to hospitals, for example, perhaps even to welfare services.
Those sorts of things, yes. There's an added dimension to this, of course, that may have been touched on earlier, where a number of these church-run institutions, hospitals or schools, actually receive a large amount of government funding. And it ought to be permissible for the government to say, well, if you're receiving this funding, you do it on condition that you don't discriminate.
Well, let's examine that one at the very start, because it seems a clear one to understand. Rob Ward, let's come back to you. And if any of you have any observations on this, please feel free to just butt into the conversation and let me know. Rob Ward, isn't it fair enough that you have a voluntary association? It might be okay for that voluntary independent association to do and practice as it wills, but once that voluntary association, be it a church or a hospital or a school, begins to receive government money, then it's spending the money of the taxpayer. It's not spending the money of the members of that voluntary association, and therefore should be subject to the same disciplines that the rest of civil society is subject to.
Well, are you assuming, John, that therefore that the members of that voluntary association, be it a church or whatever, don't pay taxes?
No, but I'm assuming that they get more in the subsidies of the schools than they're paying in. That is why they've asked the government to subsidise them.
Interestingly, I think Kevin could comment on the dollar figures there, being more of an educational expert than I am, but it's my understanding that non-government schools actually receive considerably less of taxpayers' money. By the way, I'm a taxpayer, you're a taxpayer, we're all taxpayers. So it's not government money, it's taxpayers' money, which we all contribute to. They actually receive a smaller amount of that pool back. And I think that's one of the reasons why the government, successive governments of whatever flavour, have continued to support faith-based organisations in education, in hospital work, in social welfare, because they know they actually get a lot more, if you'll excuse the expression, bang for their buck, out of faith-based organisations than they do out of organisations simply run on a secular basis.
Kevin Donnelly?
Well, it's true. If you look at the productivity figures, to generalise, government, state and federal spend approximately $11,000 per student in a government school. The equivalent figure in a non-government school is about $5,500.
Yes, but that's because those people choose to opt out of the government system. And if they wish to opt out of the government system, then why should the government support them?
Well, what about freedom of choice, John?
That's exactly the point. Governments say, we'll provide government schools for everybody. Free, compulsory and secular was the saying back in the 1880s when this debate was raging through Australian society.
So what you want is that if I opt out, all the money that I pay in tax that would ordinarily be spent to educate my child, I lose that completely.
Do I get a discount? Unless you go to a government school, I guess.
Do I get a discount if I choose to send my child to a non-government school?
Well, I don't want to get into this argument. I'm just putting the way the argument has been placed in the past.
One point I was going to mention is that, and I've taught in government schools and non-government school. I was raised as a Catholic. I really have experience of both systems in a broader sense. The reality is that, as you well know, that historically the government school system was set up as secular, and religious schools have a completely different mission in terms of enacting the gospel's teachings. Now, whether it's a Catholic school, a Presbyterian or Anglican, and I've taught in those schools, you have religious ceremonies right through the week in terms of students at the schools can do communion or confirmation. You often have assemblies where you have prayers. Now, teachers who teach in those schools must understand that it's not a secular school. Now, thank goodness we still live in a society where people can make the choice. So parents obviously make that choice. If you look at Australia, over 30% of young people now go to non-government schools. At year 11 and 12, that figure is 40%. So if you're looking at, say, year 12, 40% of students around Australia go to religious schools. It's a fair amount, and the fact that it's costing governments half the amount it would cost normally would suggest that if all those students suddenly went to the government schools, we'd be bankrupt. Now, I'm not just talking about the financial side of it. I'd say morally and ethically, parents have every right to expect that a school would reflect, embody the moral and spiritual values that they think are important.
But if we're going to get back to the equal opportunity stuff...
John McIntyre, Bishop John
the
McIntyre.
The reality for me is that the Australian Christian lobby is actually misrepresenting the whole issue in saying that the Equal Opportunity Act somehow tells a church or a mosque that it can't employ people who share the same ethos as they do. The Equal Opportunity Act doesn't do that. That's a ridiculous statement. The statement,
I didn't say that.
I beg your pardon?
I don't believe I said that.
Well, I'm quoting Rob Ward in an article called Freedom of Religion is Also a Basic Right. It begins with the words, telling a church or mosque it can't employ people who share its ethos is a bit like telling the Labor Party it must employ liberals. By implication, you're saying that the Equal Opportunity Act tells churches that they can't employ Christian teachers. That's ridiculous.
Well, it's a matter of having the freedom to positively favour.
But no, that's not what the Equal Opportunity Act does. The Equal Opportunity Act is saying that when you employ a person, it doesn't say you can't employ a person who has the same ethos as you. In any organisation, obviously employers are looking for people who share the culture and ethos of that organisation. I don't care what the organisation is. It could be a bank. And we know that that's perfectly appropriate, and it's not discriminatory to do it. The issue is whether or not you're going to discriminate against a person, another human being, on the basis of issues like, to put it broadly, disability, race, ethnicity, and then issues like sexuality, gender, marital status, and so on. And I think it's fair enough that the Equal Opportunity Act is saying that we should not, as churches, be allowed to discriminate against people on those bases. That doesn't mean we can't employ people who agree with us. That's ridiculous.
Bishop John McIntyre, let me ask you a question here, because this it almost seems absurd, but sometimes these absurd arguments are useful for us. What about the issue of the Anglican Church and the priesthood? The Anglican Church says the priesthood is male unless a group of Anglicans in a certain diocese decide that women can be priests as well. Now, that's the act of a voluntary association, saying that the exercise of certain functions shall only be undertaken on the basis of gender. Isn't that a discriminatory act? Should the Anglican Church be subject to civil law on this issue?
Well, I mean, I guess I have to be honest and say that the reason I started being uncomfortable with the Equal Opportunity Act was when women in the Diocese of Sydney couldn't actually be ordained as women, and that the church didn't have to answer to anybody for that. So I think that there's always a matter of conflict between what you believe and what is acceptable in terms of the affirmation of the fundamental dignity of every human being. And I think that you've got to have the right... To me, the issue is, what's the right starting point for this discussion? I don't know. Obviously, you're going to have to weigh up, and you're going to have to compromise, and you're going to have to come to some point where you can find a way forward. But just to give a kind of a blanket exemption to the churches on the basis... You know, what if they had some bizarre belief? Do we give them a blanket exemption on the basis of... you know, I don't know. I can't think of anything bizarre enough.
Well, I'm sure someone will give us an example.
I'll give you an example of a bizarre belief. There are some people that might suggest that female genital mutilation is part of their cultural rights. I would suggest that the equal opportunity law, and in fact other laws, would prevent that from being used as an excuse to carry out such a barbaric act. So exactly. It is a matter of balancing rights and responsibilities.
Yeah, and I don't dispute that it's a matter of balance and rights and responsibilities. What I find to be the difficulty for me is that we have, as churches, this blanket exemption that doesn't really require us to argue a case. And I think we should be required to argue a case about the balance of rights and responsibilities and not just have a blanket exemption.
Michael Pearce, let me bring you in here. As I said, Liberty Victoria, an organisation concerned with civil liberties. What are the implications for civil society here? What are your concerns? I mean, one could see it at one level as simply a worker's rights issue. That is, a worker has a right in whatever situation they employed to be subject to the same rights and disciplines as any other worker in any other job.
Well, I think there is that issue, but I think too, going back to your earlier illustration about ordination of female priests, for example, that the position of a priest is different to the position of, say, a cleaner or a gardener at a church school or even a maths teacher. Obviously, the role of the priesthood is central to the exercise of religious beliefs and practices, and the churches can make an argument that they ought to be permitted to discriminate in that area. There's a big debate, obviously, in the Anglican Church about whether that argument is correct or not, but I don't want to buy into that, but really just to contrast that with the position of somebody who's doing, say, you know, the job of a gardener or a cleaner at a school, it's very hard to see how you can make a justification for discriminating in that sort of position. And that really does then become a civil rights issue.
Kevin Donnelly.
It's interesting the point just made then about the gardener. Now, I think a gardener you might expect, well, if he's doing his job, let him work at what he does. But if you look at the Catholic Education Archdiocese of Melbourne, their guidelines for employing staff, they make it very clear that they're not simply employing a teacher, whether they're a geography teacher or a science teacher or a mathematics teacher. They're actually employing a teacher that really lives and abides by the faith in terms of their religious beliefs. So it's an essential element of that school's mission that all of those who live and work and pray there are committed to the faith. So it's not simply a matter of saying, well, you're a science teacher or an English teacher. The reality is often these teachers are involved in co-curricular, they're involved in pastoral, they take kids on camp, they do prayer meetings with these children. And even as an English teacher, I know that discussing tragedy, Shakespeare, for example, you often get around to morality, spiritual values, and you would hope that whoever's teaching in a particular religious school is in tune with what that school is trying to achieve.
That can be part of the job description then, can't it? And you can make an argument, therefore, that a knowledge of the beliefs and the doctrines and the practices of the particular religion is required for that particular position. But there'd be many positions where surely it wouldn't be required. Somebody who's just, say, a maths teacher just teaches maths and that's all.
Let me shift the discussion for a moment out of school and into, say, welfare agencies, where quite often you will have a client service provider relationship. Now, should welfare agencies be allowed to say that anybody who works for us as a welfare as an employee, be they a qualified social worker or whatever, delivering services to the public, should be a confessing member of our faith tradition?
I think they should be, John, I think they should be free to do that. I think they should be compelled to do that. But certainly the existence of welfare organisations, you know, Anglicare is a good example, Salvation Army, lots of other, you know, Catholic welfare, their reason for existing is really an expression of their faith. So you go back to the core, non-core argument again, where those agencies are an expression of the Christian faith. And obviously the culture and the ethos and the atmosphere and the community in which they work should reflect that, and I think they should be free to exercise that freedom.
Michael Pearce.
But surely it could be the expression of a different faith as well, couldn't it?
Oh, Muslim, Buddhist, whatever, yeah.
Engage in charitable work, and I don't see why you couldn't be expressing your Jewish faith by working for a Catholic welfare agency by doing the same kind of welfare work.
And I think some do. But the point is that the freedom to make that decision should rest with the organisation, not be mandated from on high.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. We're discussing discrimination in employment when it comes to religion. Should religious organisations, and perhaps some other organisations, have the right to discriminate in employment on the basis of faith tradition, marital status, gender, sexual orientation? 1300 800 222. The phones are open. 1300 800 222. Give Noel a call and he'll flick your name up on the board and we'll allow you to participate in the conversation. Let's go to this wider question. Kevin Donnelly, there is an issue here of how wide the faith community is, and this is where it borders into civil society. Let's go back and take the example of the gardener, for instance. You could make an argument, I guess, arguing from the faith community position that, look, the gardener in the garden doing his job is just as much a vital part of that faith community, if it's, say, a Muslim school, as any other person, and he has as much chance to chat and talk and influence the kids as any others. So that there is an argument there about the faith community being something broader. But there is also an argument, surely, about those faith communities still at some point have to integrate with civil society. And unless they follow the basic norms of civil society, you cease to have what can be called a cohesive civil society at some point.
That, if we could spend probably a week discussing that issue. I suppose my view would be that from a religious school's point of view, obviously that school is, in terms of the Bible or whether it's the Quran or whether it's the, you know, whatever the religion, the school is there not simply to teach a secular curriculum. It's there to teach the faith of that particular community, that particular school. And these schools in around Victoria are often critical, essential parts of their faith-based community. So a lot of these people would see one another and their children, whether it's Sunday Mass or whatever. In small communities in country Victoria, everybody generally knows what everybody else is doing. And I suppose in the back of my mind, I would hope that in terms of discrimination, that it's not done to, it's not too onerous in a sense that people are looking at what you do after hours or following you around 7 days a week in terms of checking on where you're living or who you're going out with. But, and in that sense, I think there's a bit of tolerance, a bit of freedom there. But I think at the end of the day, to use that cliche, schools have to have the right about who they employ. And I remember community schools in Victoria during the 60s and 70s where the schools could actually employ their own staff. And it was a great thing to have people who would work there who were committed to that particular school's curriculum and philosophy. And I also think that's more important when it comes to morality and spiritual values. If you look at the research, a lot of parents are choosing these faith-based schools because of the lack of what they see in terms of structured approach to ethical values, moral values. And so it's very important that the teachers who are in those schools are committed to that faith.
Bishop John McIntyre, as an Anglican bishop, you have schools come under your area of responsibility. How do you respond to what Kevin's just said?
Well, I see an irony, I suppose, because some of the schools that are church schools are the most elitist schools in our society, and some of the values that they teach about elitism really go hard against the Christian gospel. And it strikes me that, you know, if we really want an educational institution that reflects the values of Jesus Christ, then picking on certain issues of morality and not other issues of morality is, you know, a bit crass, really. And that's another part of my concern about this whole debate. You know, we single out sexuality, gender, marital status. Why don't we single out arrogance or pride or elitism or materialism? I mean, these are some of the most materialist schools producing people committed to the most materialist values that you could think of. How is that consistent with the Christian faith? It strikes me that you know, if we really want an educational institution that reflects Christian values, then the first thing we need to be able to say about it is that it's not elitist and that it actually is inclusive of the most disadvantaged groups in our society or the most marginalised. That would really reflect the teaching of Jesus Christ.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. We're talking about religion, discrimination, education, hospitals, health and employment. What are your opinions? Should it be the case that religious groups are allowed to have exemptions from equal opportunity employment provisions, or should it be the case that religious institutions, as an important part of the matrix of civil society, should be required to adhere to the canons, the basic canons, basic ground rules of civil society in areas of employment, just as they are in areas of occupational health and safety? Give us your opinion. 1-300-800-222. Let's say hi to Kathy in East Sydney first up. Hello, Kath. What is it you'd like to say?
Yeah, well, I'm just a bit sort of puzzled. I think, does this mean that they are exempt from all discrimination laws of the type that what Bishop McIntyre is saying?
Michael Pearce, you're the best to say what the ambit of this legislation proposed
is. Yes, well, at the moment there's a very large range of exemptions for religious organisations from the equal opportunity laws, and the proposal that's been announced by the Victorian government has been to narrow down those exemptions and exclude them, for example, on the basis of race. However, to retain the ability to discriminate, for example, on the basis of sexual orientation. So that's the change that's been proposed in Victoria.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to agree. The only one that I'm sort of finding that I can agree with is the bishop, because from other reasons. I mean, to me, it just seems like it's a reason they're trying to just avoid litigation. You know, I think that's one of the big things. I mean, what makes these people so different that they can be trusted? That are they any better human beings? Are they a superior race that they won't discriminate and they don't need these laws? I have been discriminated in a religious organisation, and it certainly wasn't very nice. And they could use these laws to discriminate on some other ground as an excuse to get rid of somebody. I mean, and it is. If it's about ethos, if it's about values, that's different to practising. I mean, if there's a sort of a... I mean, I just think the bishop is the only one that's made any sense tonight, and I think it's an awful grab for power. You know, I mean, the sort of extra power that it would give these organisations, who already have huge power anyway, because they stand on this sort of pillar of being better than everybody else because they're religious somehow. And yet they can be some of the worst employers. You ask any employer advocate and they'll say that the churches can be the worst employers of all.
That's an uncontested statement.
Well, Rob Ward, thanks, Kath, for your observation. Rob Ward, let's get your response to that. Kathy's suggesting that such a blanket provision could be used as a cover for other sorts of discrimination.
Well, there's a blanket provision now, and it was interesting in the public hearings that the bastion of equal opportunity, Equal Opportunity Commission, couldn't present one single case of discrimination.
Well, there was one in The Age this morning. There was a case of discrimination against a woman who was pregnant, who was dismissed because she wasn't married from a Catholic school. I mean, there's an example.
Well, the truth. Now, I saw that article myself. I noticed that you only got one side of the story. There wasn't much of a response from the Catholic school.
But it still happened. I mean, was she lying?
Well, the point is that the Equal Opportunity Commission, when presented in a government inquiry, tell us about all the complaints you've received, tell us about all the discrimination that's going on, couldn't point to a single example. And you've got to ask yourself why.
Well, I've just pointed to a single example.
Michael, I'll get Michael Pearce into the discussion here. Michael Pearce, your observation here.
I think Bishop McIntyre again makes a good point that occurred to me as well this morning. And the fact that people don't make complaints doesn't mean that discrimination doesn't happen. The complaints where they're made would be only the tip of the iceberg, I think. Most of the data tends to support that.
Let's go to another call to Mac. Hello, Mac. What would you like to say?
Evening, gentlemen. How are we?
Good.
I'd just like to... practicing Catholic, went to a Catholic school, my partner. She teaches at the at a public school, and we just find it funny that you can say that a certain person can't teach at a school because of a belief. I don't know. Is it backwards? I mean, I work for a big company. We have to employ people on merit for who they are and what they are as they come through an interview without asking the question of religion, creed, culture. Is it backwards? Do we want something? I mean, there's numerous examples. I mean, my mother is a huge Catholic, and, you know, we're in this position that my partner can't teach at a Catholic school because he teaches at a public school.
John McIntyre.
Well, I suppose you do want to know that I think it's perfectly legitimate to say that you want a person to be supportive of the basic ethos of any organisation that employs. I don't have an actual issue with asking people questions about whether or not they are happy to work in an institution that espouses particular values and beliefs. I therefore don't think it's an unreasonable question to ask, but I think it is unreasonable to say that unless you believe in the way we believe, you cannot be employed in this organisation. So I think I'm partially in agreement with what's just been said, but also do see the value in being able to have employees who are not working against the values and ethos of the organisation.
But what about somebody who may? What about, say, a fundamentalist evangelical Christian working in a Muslim school, or the other side of the coin, a proselytising Muslim working in an evangelical Christian school? How do you go handle that one? Kevin Donnelly.
Well, I would suggest that in both those cases, the people involved should not be employed, and that the school would have the right to discriminate. And it's an interesting interpretation here. Throughout our conversation, we've all assumed that the ability to discriminate is somehow bad or unjust. But in fact, I think if you stop for a moment, you'd realise that every day we discriminate in a positive sense. Now, whether it's literature, whether it's music, whether it's how we act, how we live our lives, we have to make moral choices. We have to discriminate. Now, I'd argue that an institution, if it's based on a particular religion, has the right to discriminate so as to support that religion.
Now, I agree. I agree entirely with that. I think we're always making choices on the basis of discrimination. The question to me is, I'm not assuming that we don't discriminate. Of course we discriminate. The question for me is where we discriminate on an unjustified basis. And that, to me, is a problem.
So is it unjustified, Bishop John, to ask a teacher in a school that is, let's say it's a Christian school for the sake of the argument, that that person would actually be a Christian and would uphold the values of that school and model them in the way that we would hope a teacher would?
I don't think it's unjustified to ask a person whether they are aware that the values of this school are such and such, and that they would be happy to work in and be supportive of those values and beliefs. They may, I know of situations that I'm personally involved with. I'm on the board of an Anglican school where the principal is not a professing Christian, but where he is very supportive of the school promoting its Christian values and beliefs. And I have no problem with that situation. But if I were to say to him, okay, you're out of here, sunshine, because you are not a professing Christian, I think I would be unjustified in discriminating against him in that way.
It depends, I guess, on the culture of the school, whether it's Anglican in name or whether it's, if you like, a more genuine faith-based community, and many of the smaller Christian schools, and indeed, as I understand it, many of the Catholic schools operate much more on a faith-based community structure.
Well, we believe that what we have there is a Christian faith community that is an educational institution, and that is what we promote the school as. It has to fulfil its educational objectives. Otherwise, we should not expect it to be supported, certainly by government funding, but we see it as part of our church.
Can I ask a broader question? It touches on the one earlier, Kevin Donnelly, that you suggested we could spend a number of hours on, but let me ask it anyway, because it does actually touch on our understanding of the nature of our society. Even this week, there's been discussions as to whether we're a secular society or a pluralist society or a democratic society, and we all carry around in our heads small understandings of what our society is and means. And the whole notion of what democracy means in practice is involved with what are called voluntary associations and how they manifest themselves in society and to what extent they can remove themselves from the general tenor of that society. Are there limits here that do need to be placed generally?
When I was up in Canberra, I worked for a year as a chief of staff, and I was quite interested to see that every parliamentary session started with the Lord's Prayer. Now, and that happens around Australia, and I think the latest ABS, it's maybe 60, 70% of Australians still describe themselves as Christian. Now, if you look at our traditions, our institutions, our history, it's very much grown out of a Judeo-Christian heritage. So, and this is what interests me about when you talk about civil society. I mean, civil society doesn't exist in a vacuum, and it didn't get here from nowhere. In fact, if you look at the history of Western civilization, the Bible, the teachings of Jesus have had a profound and lasting influence on civil society. And I suppose that's what makes it difficult, because in an increasingly secular society, where people are no longer, some people are no longer raised in that faith, they believe somehow that what's happened has happened magically, when in fact the values are embedded in how we live our lives.
Michael Pearce, your observation on this general societal question.
Well, I think I can agree with everything that I think it was Rob was just speaking said, but I still don't see the connection between that and the proposition that churches should be allowed to discriminate in a way that nobody else is permitted to discriminate. What's the logical connection there?
Kevin?
Well, I think, as I was trying to suggest, and maybe I wasn't clear enough, the reality is that our civil society has grown out of and relies on a moral and a spiritual base in terms of how we live our lives, how we make decisions, how our institutions are run. And in particular, more so if you're a religious or a faith-based school, because your mission is to enact, both through deed and word, the faith that you're committed to. So if you're going to employ someone, you must have the right to say no to those people who, for whatever reason, publicly, privately, their lifestyle or their actions are contrary to that religion.
But even if it's no part of their job description to be participating in or imparting the doctrine or the practices of the religion?
Well, and as I said before, I taught for 18 years, and certainly in the Anglican school that I taught at, the headmaster, Colin Black, was very keen to ensure that the staff of the school understood, abided by the faith of the school in terms of what we did each day, either in the lessons or in terms of assembly when we had prayers and hymns. So I'd argue that you can't really say that if you're a mathematics teacher or a science teacher that you're somehow not involved in that faith of the school. I would suggest anybody who's teaching there has that responsibility.
A comment, if I can,
yes, Rob.
John, on this one, is that I didn't attend a non-government school. I was raised in the UK, for which I've renounced my citizenship. I'm an Aussie now. I got my interest in issues of social justice in a government school, Wandsworth Comprehensive School in London, from a geography teacher who was an avowed communist. Now, I'm sure it wasn't part of his job description to teach me about social justice, but he sparked in me a desire to see people better treated, and that's actually a big part of me exercising my faith today.
But if you'd gone to a religious school, he probably wouldn't have got a job there.
Well, it's a good point, But nonetheless, he certainly sparked something in me, for which I'm very grateful.
What's the answer to the point?
I beg your pardon?
Discriminate against just such people.
Well, there's lots of ways that people can influence. Another good example is my own son was greatly influenced by the maintenance guy at the Christian school. He probably got closer to my son in helping him through some difficult times than the official chaplain at the school. So it's a community issue.
But was the maintenance guy a practicing member of that denomination?
Yes, he was. It was a requirement of the job.
Michael Pearce, will this flow out into the Charter of Rights debate?
Well, there is a certain intersection there with the Charter debate, but of course the Charter enshrines freedom of religion and freedom of expression and directly supports the free exercise of religion.
Mm. Rob Ward?
Well, I think that you've got to join the dots. I think that this push that I think the government's finally woken up to the message, but the Charter, the Victorian Charter, hasn't done much to protect freedom of religion. You ask a doctor who's forced to carry out an abortion.
That gets into a whole other debate.
Absolutely.
John McIntyre, 15 seconds.
Oh, right. Yeah, thanks. So I just think that the fundamental principle that I want to make as a beginning point is that at the heart of Christian values and belief is the dignity of every human being. And that if we don't start there, we're not starting from a Christian base. I think that forms the basis of human rights charters. Christians were involved in establishing it, not alone, but they were certainly there. And again, I go back to the point of how bizarre it is that churches want to have exemption from the law based on that principle.
Thank you and good night. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.